final speaker of the evening is Radley Balco. Radley Balco is an award-winning investigative journalist and a senior editor with Reason Magazine. He's also a media fellow with the Cato Institute, where he did a groundbreaking report on the alarming and heavily increasing use of SWAT teams in America. He also did a report of a woman who was shot and killed in one of these botched raids, lives right down a mile from here, Cheryl Lynn Knoll, back in 2006. His work has been published in Time, Playboy, Wall Street Journal. He's been cited in the New York Times, The Atlantic Monthly, The Economist, and The National Journal. His opinions have also been cited by the Mississippi and U.S. Supreme Courts. He has helped get Corey May, who is a gentleman who lived in Mississippi and accidentally shot a cop in a botched no-knock drug raid, get him off death row and get him a new trial. And he also helped with the removal of a corrupt doctor in the state of Mississippi who had done 90% of the autopsies there for the last 20 years, Stephen Hain. He is a graduate of Indiana University. He has degrees in political science and journalism. And tonight he is here to tell us about the good news for human liberty. Please welcome Randy Balco.
I want to thank the Maryland Libertarian Party for inviting me to speak tonight. I'm a journalist with Reason Magazine. I generally cover criminal justice issues, and I probably not a surprise to most of the people in the room. Most of the time, the bad guys win and the good guys lose. So this is one of my favorite speeches to give because it's optimistic. It's the good news about human liberty. And, I mean, really fundamentally, libertarianism is an optimistic political philosophy, right? We know that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, to quote Lord Acton. And we are very sort of pessimistic about and skeptical of government and of how man uses power. But really fundamentally, at the sort of at the heart of libertarianism is this belief in the human spirit and human innovation and human ingenuity, and the idea that if left to their own devices, if left to exchange voluntarily to set up public service and civic organizations, that human beings, humanity generally, does the right thing, that we generally help one another out, and that free markets and capitalism sort of harness the inherent self-interest that sort of hardwired into us to make everyone better, to kind of lift everyone up. So this is a good news sort of speech, which I think libertarianism could use more of, particularly what's going on right now. Actually, I'm going to start with a joke, though. It's my favorite libertarian joke, and I worked at the Cato Institute for about 5 years, and Tom Palmer, who used to work at Cato, is not there anymore, used to give a speech to all the younger employees on how to give a public presentation. And the first thing he always said was, never, ever, ever start a speech with a joke. So I'm going to start my speech with a joke. So there are three gas station managers sharing a prison cell. And the prison guard sort of chatting with them, and he says, this is unusual. You have three people in the same profession sharing a prison cell. He looks at the first one, and he says, why are you here? And the manager says, well, the state regulatory authority decided that I was charging too much for gas. I'm here for price gouging. The guard says, that's terrible. He says, looks at the second guy. He says, well, why are you here? He says, well, I looked at what happened to him, and I made sure I was charging less than everyone else in the area. So they got me for uncompetitive pricing. Wow, that's terrible. And he looks at the third guy, and he says, well, why are you here? He says, well, I looked at what happened to those two. And so I, you know, every day I called the only other gas station left on the block, and I asked him what he was charging, and I made sure I was charging the exact same amount so they couldn't get me. They got me for collusion. There's a book out by Harvey Silverglaze, a civil liberties attorney, called Three Felonies a Day, and his general thesis is that if you run a small business in the U.S., it's pretty much impossible for you not to break several federal laws, including laws that are classified as felonies. In fact, in some ways, it's impossible to comply with some regulations without violating others. But that's bad news, and I'm here to talk about good news tonight. So despite the headlines, we are getting freer, and we are getting more comfortable. We're living longer. And generally, every demographic indicator that you can sort of conjure up in your head is moving in the right direction. Now, you don't often see these trends in the news because they're sort of long-term and big picture. They're not what's happening right now. but I'm going to tell you something. There's a great libertarian economist named Julian Simon who died a few years ago. And Simon was the eternally optimistic libertarian. In fact, he wrote a great book that I highly recommend for everyone called It's Getting Better All the Time. And all the book is a bunch of charts and data, but they are amazing. I mean, they talk about how, for example, something as innocuous, or sort of seemingly innocuous, as air conditioning, right? Since the early 1990s, the number of Americans who are classified as living in poverty who have air conditioning in their homes has increased from, I think it was about 20% to about 80%. That's had an effect, well, my personal theory, I haven't seen this borne out, but that's had an effect on, I think it's had an effect on the crime rate. Most homicides happen during July and August, the hotter months. The hotter cities have more homicides than cooler cities. Giving people air conditioning makes them less irritable. But it's these sorts of kind of long-term trends that we don't often see in the news that I think are worth reporting on or worth sort of calling attention to. 2 years ago, my then-girlfriend and I visited the Biltmore Estate in Asheville, North Carolina. Biltmore Estate was built by one of the Vanderbilts, and it's this glorious, huge sort of castle-like home that you can now take tours of. But as we were walking through, the thing that sort of struck me is it was built in the early 20th century, the late 19th century. As we were walking through, we were sort of talking, and it struck us that everything about the Biltmore Estate that made it sort of so opulent, so above and beyond what everyone else, how everyone else at that time was living, are all things that we have access to today relatively easily. So one of the things, go back to air conditioning. This is one of the first sort of estates in the world that had a form of air conditioning. They took water that they ran through their ice house and ran on this little sort of conveyor belt that went all through the house and went through open windows so the breeze would blow across the iced water, which would cool the home. There was a workout facility in the estate, which was unheard of at the time, right? I mean, all of these things, even lower middle class Americans have access to today. Our poor basically live the way the very wealthy lived, you know, as little as 50 or 75 or 100 years ago. And this is all because of the things that we as libertarians believe in free markets and free trade and capitalism generally. as I mentioned earlier, so every demographic trend that you can possibly think of is moving in the right direction. For the last 8 years, the U.S. has set life expectancy records. We're living longer than we ever have before. Not only that, but every demographic group is living longer than it ever has before, and the gap between white and black, between white and Hispanic, is narrowing every year in terms of life expectancy. Cancer, stroke, and heart disease, these are the three big killers, the three biggest killers in the U.S., actually, in the U.S. All three of those have been in sharp decline over the last 3 years. This is because, again, of human ingenuity, of human innovation. It's because of advances in medical technology, advances in medical treatment, the work that the pharmaceutical industry has done to give us drugs like statins. We are getting healthier. We're living better years while we are alive. And all of this is thanks, again, to the wonder of capitalism and innovation. Worldwide, we have, this is a really remarkable statistic, for the first time in human history, for the last 5 years, the number of people, the total number of people living in absolute poverty has declined. Now, over that period, world population has gone up. So we're not talking about percentages here. The total number of people living in absolute poverty has declined for the last 5 years. It's the first time in the history of humanity that that's happened. This is a remarkable statistic. A guy named David Dollar at Yale has been tracking this. And this is thanks to to free trade. It's thanks to the free exchange of goods, of services, of technology, of labor, and of culture, actually, across borders. It has lifted everyone else up, and this is something that to celebrate. And this is a this is what happens when it happens when our ideas are put into action, and when trade barriers are brought down. Nicholas Kristof is a liberal New York Times columnist. He and his wife have a book out, bestseller now, about women across the world and women's rights. But about 10 years ago, he and his wife set out for East Asia, or Southeast Asia, to write a book condemning sweatshops and the way that sweatshop workers were treated. Interesting thing happened as they were researching the book. They started talking to the people who were actually working in these so-called sweatshops. And in the end, they ended up writing a book defending sweatshops. And what they found was that the people who worked in these sweatshops loved their jobs, that there were thousands of people applying for every available job, that the only alternatives were, you know, prostitution or working in a farm where there was a 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 chance you were going to get killed or starving to death. What Kristof documents in the book, and it's another pretty amazing statistic, it took the United Kingdom 1,000 years to make the transition from a subsistence economy to what we call a sort of developed or a prosperous economy. It took the United States 100 years. It took Taiwan and Singapore 10 years. And there now are provinces in China that are doing it in 3 to 6 months. This is incredible. This is a story that isn't often told. You have people in China who are no longer starving to death thanks to the ideas, again, that we as libertarians embrace: free markets, capitalism, trade, commerce. So let's look at politics. So what, as libertarians, can we sort of take heart in the current political scene? And I agree that at the moment it would appear to be not much. But David Bowes at the Cato Institute has looked at polling data. And Bowes estimates that about 10 to 20% of the electorate can be classified as libertarian, sort of generically libertarian. That is, these are people who describe themselves as socially liberal and economically conservative. Of those people, about 70% voted for George W. Bush in 2004. About 50% voted for the Republican candidate in their congressional district in 2006. 40% of them voted Republican in 2008. What I think this shows is that there is a sizable sort of game-changing part of the electorate that is consistent with our ideas and our principles that politicians are going to have to listen to. The fact that 60% of people who could generically be described as libertarian voted for the Democratic candidate for president in 2008 looks sort of depressing now. But at the time, it was a punishment to the Republican Party for what they had done for the last 8 years. And I think what it does show is that we may not be good at trumpeting this, but we are sort of a significant chunk of the electorate that both parties are going to have to listen to. And I think there's reason to take heart in that. One thing that happened in the 2008 campaign that I don't think a lot of people noticed: there was a debate during the GOP primary where Ron Paul, who was probably, you know, the most libertarian candidate in the Republican primary, challenged Rudy Giuliani on our U.S. foreign policy. And Giuliani sort of smacked Paul down very condescendingly and derisively. And if you were watching Fox News at the time, you would have thought that that was the end of Ron Paul, that he had been humiliated and embarrassed on a national stage. But a funny thing happened. The night of that debate, Giuliani was leading all the other primary candidates in the polls. He was pulling about 30 to 35%. After that confrontation with Paul, Giuliani immediately took a nosedive in the polls, and in fact was one of the first GOP candidates to duck out of the primary, and ended up getting both less delegates than Ron Paul and raising a significantly less money than Ron Paul. It's something that I think not a lot of people remember from that campaign, but if even in the GOP primary you can have that sort of clash over foreign policy, and the libertarian candidate, the candidate who takes the libertarian position on foreign policy, would actually emerge as the candidate that both raises more money and attracts more delegates, I think is something significant and something that we ought to hold on to. The Second Amendment. Obviously, the Heller case was a huge victory for the Second Amendment, but I think really beyond that, Second Amendment really isn't a hot-button political issue anymore. The Democrats have realized that they cannot win at the polls with a platform that has aggressive gun control at its heart. You know, this, we saw this going back to the 2000 campaign, where Gore essentially just dropped gun control altogether. And the New York Times and Washington Post editorial boards are aghast at this. They can't believe that the Democrats don't care about gun control anymore. But the Democrats realize they can't win with it anymore, and they've dropped it completely. There is no more debate about how much more gun control we need. The debate is now about which gun control laws we ought to repeal. I think that's a victory. This is one of my favorite statistics from some recent polling data. Nationwide, support for legalizing marijuana, public support, is now higher than the public approval rating of either the Democrat or the Republican Party. I'd call that a victory. sorry, lost my place there. Another victory I think we can get, and if this is a little before my time, but not by much, unfortunately. In the 1970s, the critics of capitalism, people like Paul Ehrlich, were predicting that capitalism and commerce and free markets were going to be the end of Western civilization, right? We were going to sort of buy and spend and greed our way into poverty and conflict and international warfare. And basically humanity was going to sort of start circling the drain because of our unfettered sort of capitalistic appetites. A while back, I wrote an article for a Reason's website that was sort of making fun of Time magazine about their 10 most alarmist covers of all time. And one of them was from the 70s with this idea that overpopulation and commerce and capitalism were basically going to be the end of humanity. Well, it's interesting what's happened to the chief critics of capitalism, right? Probably in the last 5 years, the one guy that people turn to, the press turns to when they want someone to criticize capitalism, is this guy named Barry Schwartz from Swarthmore University. And his chief criticism of capitalism is that we have too many choices and that we get what he calls choice fatigue. And the way he describes it is that when you go to the drugstore and you see 33 different kinds of toothpaste, you're so overwhelmed that a state of ennui sets in, right? And you know, we've had all this capitalism and prosperity, but, you know, we still get stuck in traffic, and we still have buyer's remorse when, you know, we buy the iPhone over the Droid, and our friend got the Droid, and we kind of like the Droid better. Again, I think that when your chief critic's argument has gone from your philosophy is going to be the end of humanity to, because of your philosophy, I feel depressed when I look at the toothpaste aisle, I think we've won the debate. I think we've won the argument. More reasons for optimism. Roughly, people my age and younger will be the first generation raised on the Internet. And while there is a certain kind of hostility, I think, towards corporations, which that part's probably justified, but capitalism and markets in general, there's also an ethos of the Internet that embraces transparency, that embraces accountability, that embraces the idea that information wants to be free. And I think there's a lot of hope to think that the first generation raised on the Internet is going to demand a level of accountability from the government that we've never really seen before. We saw this with the Ron Paul phenomenon, where Ron Paul's biggest supporters came from the Internet, and as somebody who frequents sites like Dig and Reddit, which are these sort of social networking sites that vote articles up and down, these are very sort of liberal, left-of-center sites, but they really kind of latched on to Ron Paul because of his foreign policy, but also just kind of the general kind of anti-authority, anti-government nature of Paul's campaign. I think there is a very healthy sort of skepticism of authority and skepticism of government in what I would call the Internet generation. When the Obama White House asked for people to submit questions that would then be asked of President Obama, and then you could vote up which questions Obama would have to answer. The three top vote-getting questions that appeared on the White House site, the top four. The first one was about legalizing marijuana. The second one was about the United States' soaring incarceration rate. The third one was about if Obama was going to support legalizing online gambling. And the fourth was when Obama was going to bring the troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, the first three questions Obama just dismissed as jokes, of course, because these aren't serious people asking serious questions, of course, because they're not issues that he considered serious. I consider them serious, and I think the fact that the Internet generation voted those four issues to the top is, again, something that, as libertarians, that we should take heart in. Again, I said there is an ethos of transparency and accountability in government. There's this idea of crowdsourcing, and we've seen this with the earmark debate, and we've seen it with the health care, actually, the massive health care bill. But when these bills do finally get posted online, this is really the first time in American history where you can have literally hundreds of thousands of people sifting through these bills, and people who actually know what they're doing, right? And people who know what to look for, know where the earmarks are hidden, know where the sneaky provisions snuck in at the last minute are hidden. And congressmen have been called out about the crap that they sneak into these bills. The way that these bills are passed, these sort of midnight sessions of Congress where people are pressured. So this is really the first time in American history that we've been able to sort of harness this idea of crowdsourcing, where you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people are able to sort of sift through this stuff and find the stuff that doesn't make any sense, find the corruption, find the sneaky backroom deals, and really expose the sausage-making that's going on in Congress. This is something to take heart in. I cover criminal justice issues, and there's lots of reason for hope on what's going on in the criminal justice world. One thing that a lot of people don't realize, and we've sort of been, I think, dumbed down by the CSI TV franchise, unfortunately, but forensics, the concept of forensic science, everything from fingerprints to hair and fiber analysis, the whole idea of forensics was invented by police, and it was invented by police as a way to help police not solve crimes so much as convince juries that the person they arrested was actually guilty of the crime they were arrested for. There is really no science to forensic science. And for a long time, for example, fingerprint analysis was accepted as the gold standard in forensics. Fingerprints are never wrong. Fingerprint analysis is never wrong, except when it is. And what we've learned through science and through the private sector, people like Craig Venter at Cellular Genomics, with the onset of DNA technology and DNA science, this has been developed in the private sector by private people who were working for private profits, right? But what we got from that is DNA testing. What DNA testing has shown us is that forensic science is basically not nearly as reliable as we've been told over the years. And we've seen in the last about 10 years at least 250 people who were convicted of felonies, rape, murder generally, have been completely exonerated by DNA evidence. And this is an example, again, of where the private sector, where the ideas that we as libertarians embrace, have really exposed the corruption and the lies, I guess, that have been perpetuated by the public sector. George Orwell famously said that if you want to envision the future of mankind, picture a boot stepping on a human face forever. He may have been right, and he may still be right, but today there's a good chance that somebody nearby is going to have a cell phone with video, and they're going to capture that and post it on YouTube. And exposing and documenting government corruption and government abuse is half the battle. And we've seen this time and time again. If you go to YouTube and type in the phrase police abuse, you're going to see hundreds and hundreds of videos that people have captured of police officers abusing, beating, shooting in some cases, people. And, you know, in the past, when you've had a confrontation with the police officer, it was your word against the police officers. And because he had a badge and a gun and a government paycheck, your word really didn't mean squat. Now we have video, and what the video is showing that the police routinely lie in these situations. There have been countless cases where the police reports don't match with the video that we've seen subsequently. One of the more famous cases was on the public transportation system in the Bay Area in California on New Year's Day of last year, where a police officer shot a man while he was handcuffed point blank, and it was sort of during the height of as people were coming back from New Year's festivities. Everybody had their cell phone cameras on. There were hundreds and hundreds of videos of this basically assassination from all different angles. And what I really sort of, what heartened me about all of this is the first thing the police tried to do was confiscate every cell phone in the area. And there were so many cell phones that they couldn't possibly confiscate them all. And everybody saw that the police were arresting this guy. They were screaming at this guy that he was incapacitated. And as soon as the cop drew his gun from the side, everybody hit record on their cell phones. And I think there's a lot to sort of take heart in that. I mean, other than the fact that cops are killing people, that's something to take heart in. The fact that everybody sort of knows that when they see something like this going on, it's important to document it and get it on record. There are websites now called, like, Quick, QIK.com, which allow you actually to simultaneously live stream to a separate server through satellite technology video. So if you see, if you're pulled over, for example, or if you think you're about to be the victim of some sort of police abuse, or if you're witnessing it or watching it, and you have a cell phone with internet capability, you can hit record, and the video will instantly beam to the Quick servers, which are located, I'm not sure where, probably California somewhere. And even if the police officer confiscates your cell phone and deletes the video or throws the cell phone against the wall, the video has already been preserved and documented on an off-site server, and there's nothing that they can do about it. So this is a great example of where technology is sort of subverting the power of the state, and I think it's something that we ought to celebrate. You know, for all of human history, and this is sort of where Orwell's quote comes from, government has abused its citizenry, and when the citizenry rises up, the government cracks down and blood is spilled. But we are, with technology, with human ingenuity, we are finding ways to get around that. I mean, look at what happened in Iran last summer, right? We had we know the name of Nina, the woman who was shot by the sort of thugs for the Iranian government, because we saw her bleeding to death in the street on our computers. This is because someone had a cell phone with video capability, with the ability to instantly beam the images that he was seeing. And, you know, this sort of started with Tiananmen Square, right? I think one of probably the most iconic libertarian images from the 20th century was Tank Man, the Chinese dissident standing up against the Beijing or the Chinese tank. And this is something that's been developing for 20 or 30 years, but it's really gotten to the point where this technology has really been democratized. You can now buy a camera over the internet that's about the size of a stick of gum, and it will cost you $20, including shipping. And it'll take not great video, but video that will accurately portray what's going on in front of you. And I think we're going to see the technology that allows you to sort of stream this stuff live instantly to off-site servers. I think that's going to become more affordable and available. And so I think what we've hit at this point is we've sort of hit a tipping point where I think technology and innovation and the desire to sort of be free and to hold the people who govern us accountable has outpaced the ability of government to suppress all of those trends. You know, the government is never, ever going to be able to censor the internet at this point. I mean, there are just too many connections going out in too many different places. And we see this in countries that are trying to, like China. You know, there is a firewall in China, but you can also get around it. And really, more importantly, Chinese people know what is being censored, which again is sort of half the battle when you know when you're being censored and you know what information you're not allowed to access. Information sharing, aggregation, I mean, technology has really empowered us in a lot of ways. I wrote, was mentioned in my introduction, I wrote a paper for Cato on these SWAT teams. One of the things we did with that paper, I documented about 300 botched SWAT raids over the last 10 years for that paper, just sort of confront the idea that this almost never happens and it's not something we need to worry about. But one thing that the tech people at Cato did to sort of illustrate the point is they used a Google Maps application where they plotted each of these raids that I had researched. And you can click, you can go to cato.org/raidmap, all one word, and you can see this map, and you can click on these little thumbnails, thumbtacks all over the United States, and instantly you can get a description of exactly what happened. And what makes that really useful, I think, is that now when a botched raid happens somewhere, the one in Prince George's County a couple years ago, for example, with Shai Calvo, a reporter will call me, they'll Google search SWAT team or whatever, and my name comes up, and they'll call me and they'll say, you know, do you know of any, is this a problem in this area? And you send them to this map, and they click on the map, and they click on Maryland, and they get the last, you know, 15 botched raids that have happened in Maryland, and they sort of instantly know. And it's been used by libertarian activists, for example, to write letters to the editor. You know, a SWAT raid happens, and the press coverage gives its little sort of typical kind of deferring to whatever the police department is saying about the raid. Somebody will write a letter to the editor, you know, using the map to say, well, wait a minute. I mean, there were 4 raids just like this in the last 3 years. Clearly, you know, something's going wrong here, and the police aren't telling us the whole story. So, again, this is an example of, and I'm using my own example because I'm most familiar with it, but there are lots of similar examples of where the Institute for Justice, for example, has done a similar map plotting eminent domain abuses all over the U.S. So again, it's a great way to sort of aggregate information, make information more available and usable and attainable to the people that we're trying to convince. Just generally, culturally, I think we're finding more freedom. And again, this is not because the government is granting us more freedom, but it's because through capitalism and markets and human innovation, we're creating sort of more avenues to freedom. Again, support for both medical marijuana and all legalizing marijuana has never been higher. If you have sort of any sort of quirky niche lifestyle choices, thanks to the internet, you can now find people who think the same way you do. You know, I would argue that this is generally, I mean, as long as there aren't children involved or unconsenting adults involved, this is generally a good thing, right? I mean, people are no longer have to feel ashamed about their preferences. And the internet sort of provides avenues to people. And in fact, there have been studies done showing that, and I know this is going to sound hard to believe, but it's been peer-reviewed, that internet pornography is actually partially to credit for the massive decline we've seen in the rape rate over the last 25 or 30 years. The idea is that you're giving people an outlet that they didn't have before, and it's an outlet that they're using instead of actually victimizing people and exploiting people. Generally, I think we're more socially tolerant of individual choice than have ever been before. You know, capitalism has made us well-fed. Our lives are easier than ever. We're living longer than ever. And one example I like to give about this is just music, right? Think about 150 years ago. How often would you get a chance to listen to music? You know, maybe at your church, maybe if you had a relative who had a fiddle or a banjo or a guitar. But the number of opportunities you would have over the course of your life to listen to music, any music, much less great music, you know, you could probably count on both hands. I mean, now we can instantly listen to the greatest symphonies in the world, play the greatest compositions in the world, you know, within however long it takes you to download it from iTunes. I mean, this is sort of trivial because I think we take it for granted, but this is a remarkable sort of addition to our lives that I think not a lot of people think about. as I mentioned, every cultural indicator right now is pointing in the right direction. The rape rate actually is at its lowest point since we've been keeping statistics, which is really remarkable. Divorce is down. The violent crime rate has been dropping since the early 1990s, and it's actually at the lowest rate it's been since the early 1960s. The abortion rate is down dramatically. Teen pregnancy rates are down dramatically. And again, we're living longer than we ever have before. And this has all occurred over a period where technology, where the internet, where commerce, trade have given us more choices and more freedom, I think, than ever before, in spite of the government, not because of the government. But the idea that giving people more freedom and control over their own lives is going to cause us all to make bad choices, and we're all going to sort of descend into this kind of Hobbesian nightmare, I think really hasn't been borne out by what's actually happened. We've been given more choices, we've been given more freedom, thanks to our own ingenuity, and we're better for it, and we're living better lives for it. finally, There's a historian slash economist named James L. Payne, who I think is still at Yale University. But he wrote a great book called A History of Force. And it's a really interesting concept. What he did was he categorized several different types of force, coercion used on people against their will. And what he found is that force has been in rapid decline over the last 500 years of human history, and particularly in the 20th century. We sort of think of the 20th century as one of the bloodiest in human history, but it really wasn't proportionally in terms of total number of people killed generally by governments. It was the bloodiest. But if you look at like the proportion of the human population that was killed by other parts of the human population, it wasn't at all. And in fact, it was the least bloody bloody century in recorded history. In every single category that Payne categorized, from homicide to war to slavery, things like ritual killings, assassinations, every one of them has had a dramatic decline over the last 500 years, and an even more dramatic decline over the last 100 years. And Payne's theory is that the reason for this dramatic decline in the use of coercion of humans on other humans is prosperity. Prosperity has sort of raised us all up. When you are sort of live in an environment or a social environment, a society where you can expect 3 out of your 5 kids to die before the age of 5, where you can expect 4 of your 6 siblings to die in some sort of war, you sort of develop a tolerance for death, for bloodshed, for violence. And we don't have that sort of tolerance anymore. There is this sort of idea that we expect, when we have a child, we expect that child's going to live, and we're going to see them graduate from high school and graduate from college and get married. We don't sort of tolerate violence and bloodshed and death all around us anymore, because prosperity has lifted us up. We don't have disease and famine to worry about. And his theory basically is that since the Industrial Revolution, we have dramatically improved our standard of living, and with that has come an intolerance for coercion and for violence. And I think it really speaks to kind of the human spirit and sort of this desire for human flourishing, that as we sort of get more prosperous and more wealthy, we're less likely to force people to do things that they don't want to do. I'm going to try to make some lemons out of lemonade. Thomas Jefferson said that liberty tends to lose ground to the state in small increments. When the state tries to take our liberty in huge chunks, people tend to rise up. There's nothing small or incremental about what the current administration is trying to take away from us. And I think we've seen this with the Tea Party movement, where people who've never held a sign up in their life are going out and protesting the kind of takeover of the private sector that we're seeing. And I think we are going to see a resistance to what's going on, and I think we are going to see kind of a mass shift. I mean, unfortunately, I think most people think their only other alternative is the Republican Party, which, as we know from the last prior 8 years, isn't any better. But I do think that a lot of people, a lot of that 20% that we talked about earlier, moved to Obama because they were tired of the Republicans and the Republicans who didn't stick to their principles of living in government. And now that they see that the Democrats aren't going to be any better in such close proximity to the Republican administration, maybe we'll start to see an opening for another party to sneak in. We are in some ways also, I think, past the point of no return when it comes to the national debt. It's hard to sort of fathom a way that we're going to be able to pay this off, particularly when Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security obligations kick in. And to be honest, I mean, I think the federal government having to default on its obligations will be a good thing, because it will sort of teach people a lesson about putting that much faith and trust in the federal government. And I don't think we'll see those kinds of obligations from politicians again for a while. It may take that sort of medicine to get people to realize that you can't sort of put all your faith in government to solve all of your problems. we are seeing, at some levels, the GOP kind of rediscovering its limited government principles. I'm confident that they'll abandon those as soon as they're voted back into power. But, you know, 70% of Americans were opposed to the bailouts. And, you know, as libertarians, you know, it's easier to make our case to say that AIG execs shouldn't be sent to Cancun, or they shouldn't be, you know, taxpayers shouldn't be footing the bill for $35,000 toilets, than it is for us to make the case, for example, for welfare reform, right? So we're sort of in a unique position, I think, rhetorically, where we can rail against this stuff and not look like the corporate hacks that we're often unfairly portrayed as. So the government is going to have to own these failures. The 70s gave us Reagan. I think the 2000s will give us Reagan, who talked a good talk at least, if he didn't follow it up. The 2000s, I think, will give us something similar. But I think as libertarians, we should also expect that that person is not going to have the sort of cultural hang-ups that we saw from Reagan because, as we just discussed earlier, Americans are developing a new kind of sense of tolerance, and they're not going to put up with that. So I guess the general sort of thesis of my good news tonight is that I think that personal freedom and sort of the taste for freedom, as we say in my home state of Indiana, is already out of the barn, right? There's really no way that government can kind of rein in the freedom, the liberation of information that we've seen over the last 15 or 20 years. So I think that there's reason to kind of to have optimism and to look forward to where this technology and innovation and kind of opening up of world trade and world commerce is going to take us. So thank you.